Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness some scenes from the next attraction to play this theater. This picture, truly one of the most unusual ever filmed, contains scenes which under no circumstances should be viewed by anyone with a heart condition or anyone who is easily upset. We urgently recommend that if you are such a person or the parent of a young or impressionable child now in attendance, that you and the child leave the auditorium for the next 90 seconds.
Good day, mates. Welcome to another episode of the Video Nasty Project. This time, we're going to go down under, well, down under-ish, because we're actually watching a movie from New Zealand, not Australia, but it still counts as an Ausploitation classic called Dead Kids. Let's roll the trailer and we'll be back in a second.
Strange behavior. A movie of mystery, horror, and suspense.
Clear and unnatural picture begins to form in my mind. They're gonna strap me into some chair and pull for all of my grace.
Would you just wait a minute and listen to me? Two sessions, 2 days, $100 a day.
Behavior is nothing more than the sum of the mechanical activities of our bodies.
I was just wondering, are you doing anything tonight?
Oh, he's dead. And the dead don't come back and take revenge.
Somebody help me!
We've heard your views on our work in the past, Mr. Brady.
Save the crap for somebody else. You got a list of people in the program?
Now just relax, Pete. It'll be over in no time.
It started all over again.
Let me go!
Pete,
let me go!
Pete, what's wrong?
Pete! Mr. Brady, I see you found your way.
Pete, are you ready?
The choice is yours, Mr. Brady. Either give him the gun or shoot him. The choice is yours, Mr. Brady.
Oh, Jesus.
What did you do to my kid? What did you do?
Strange behavior.
And welcome back. We just got done watching the trailer for Dead Kids, aka Strange Behavior. A little movie that you've probably never heard of that comes from Down Under.
It was supposed to be a trilogy originally, with starting with that movie, then Strange Invaders, and another film which never materialized.
Yeah, it was like The Strange Doctor Strange or something like that.
And this was a typical exploitation film by Anthony Ginnane, the Australian producer from hell who loved to make those really good movies like Phantasm with an F back in the 70s before the American Phantasm came out, and that was related to porn.
So the movie is about this small town. Is set in Illinois, but it was really shot in New Zealand. And you can kind of tell in places that it was shot in New Zealand because there's a lot of Fosters all over the place in there.
Yeah, and it doesn't look like a typical, even an old-fashioned American town. It just looks too Australian for anybody who's ever seen Australian movies.
The movie starts out with this kid at home, and his parents are going to go out for the evening, and they're like, okay, bye, Mom, bye, Dad, we'll catch you later. And the lights go out, he gets a candle, and starts wandering around making himself, you know, okay, well, I'm going to go empty out the fridge because there's no power. And it's this great scene of, like, lights and shadow and, like, you know, here he is and he's projecting this massive shadow on the wall. And he starts doing, like, the little butterfly thing, the shadow puppet thing. And then, out of nowhere, you see a second figure with a knife, only in the shadow, stab his shadow.
Three times. You know, once, twice, thrice, and down he goes.
So this movie really follows your set your tone and set your audience expectations straight out of the gate very well.
And it's a really well-constructed scene, too, because you don't see the killer.
But you do hear him gurgling and gasping for breath and whatnot, which ends the scene. But the thing is, it carries over immediately to the next scene where he gasps more or less his last as it starts to fade out, which really anchors these scenes together and fills it with total dread.
We then pick up the story with Pete Brady, who is this just getting out of high school, and he is going to go to college. And he wants to go to the small town college. But his dad, the local sheriff, says, no. You really want to go experience some life, go get some life experience, go to like up to Chicago, go to a university town, go get some life experience. And the kid's like, no, I want to stay here. Being that he's also a high school student, he's broke. So he wants to make some quick cash. And his buddy says, hey, they've got this laboratory up at the college. They pay me $100 a day to do like experiments and stuff. You want to come up?
So these kids go to this university where this professor and his assistant, who's actually running the program, have this film taken probably in the 50s of this kind of big brother looking older man who's doing experiments with animals. In this case, a chicken.
That would be the good Dr. Lassange, who died many, many years ago, and his assistant is continuing on with his work.
These kids decide, well, we're going to go do this because we're going to make some big money. But meanwhile, there's something just not right in this town because there's not only one murder, but immediately thereafter, more or less, there follows a second murder. And they become progressively worse as they go.
The second murder happens at the party. The most awesome party ever.
It's done in this really good, nice house, and all these kids are basically line dancing to this 80s kind of US-style synth pop, but it's done by the Australians or the New Zealanders as a version of what our music should have sounded like back then when you wanted this kind of house party.
That's the cool thing about the movie is that if it was an American production, we probably would have got some American music. But being an Australian production, they're going to have pop music we're not really familiar with. So I thought that was kind of refreshing. It's like, hey, I don't recognize any of these songs, and they're actually pretty good.
And yeah. This is when the second murder happens. This is the Tor Johnson. This kid dressed in a Tor Johnson mask basically comes out of nowhere and is stalking one of the most hated characters in the school.
Right. This couple breaks off from the party and they want to go neck in the car, or at least the hated dude does, Waldo. And the girl, she's just like, just take me home. Fine. He drives or tries to drive. Car is stuck in the mud. And I mean, legitimately stuck in the mud. So he has to go get out and push. And that's when Tor Johnson attacks him. And it's kind of disturbing, this. You've got Tor completely emotionless. And so it kind of is a throwback a little bit to Halloween and the Michael Myers mask, but it's more expression filled and you can recognize it like, hey, that's Tor Johnson. But it's still this dead face stabbing the fuck out of this guy.
Yeah, this kind of takes the piss out of the Tor Johnson legend in this country. You know how he started off as a Swedish wrestler and came here and became basically kind of this emotionless character actor in monster movies like Plan 9 from Outer Space, where he played a zombie near the end of his career and his life. And the idea that this character actor has been taken and made into something terrifying is a different kind of dynamic from William Shatner mask, because nobody ever knew it was William Shatner, really, that they were basing the Michael Myers mask on.
They had doctored enough. They gave it the white spray paint, took off the eyebrows, basically altered enough that you wouldn't be able to say, hey, that's William Shatner. But this, you can clearly say, wait a minute, that's Tor Johnson.
And it's Tor Johnson as an undead character, which lends more cachet to the killings, as it were, because he was a classic of cinema. And so this kind of holds you in the grip of, this is more like a monster movie from the 60s or the 50s than a slasher film.
Well, not only that, the rest of the scene is also very well constructed and dramatic, because the girl, as soon as her not very well-liked boyfriend gets whacked, she runs off back to the house where the party's gone, and, you know, partly to get help and partly to just have other people around her, and she basically gets sidelined into the swimming pool, and she can't swim, and she's freaking out because she's starting to drown.
And meanwhile, Tor Johnson is stabbing at her repeatedly.
Yeah, he manages to get a good slash on her, but subverting expectations, she actually gets the best of him to the point where she gets away and to the pool, you know, with him kind of bringing up the rear, which reminds me of kind of a early 80s version of Scream, where you got this masked killer, but he keeps getting his ass handed to him by all the kids before he gets a kill in.
Yeah, but she's struggling in the pool, and she's screaming, and finally, one of the kids at the party, which is, like, right next door, hears her, and then he comes out, and other kids come out, and they basically scare the killer away from her.
And so Tor Johnson, he runs away from the party, realizing that the gig is up and he's not going to get this one. And he vaults over this fence and he's away and safe, and he pulls off the mask, and it's the friend, it's the Jimmy Olsen. And that's another expectation that's been subverted, because usually when you're watching a slasher flick, you have been trained with the slasher boom that, okay, you're not going to find out who the killer is until the very end. No, you find out halfway through the movie that it's, wait a minute, that's the killer and it's his friend. That's really weird.
Yeah, and there's more than one, because the person at the beginning of the movie that did the first kill, that ain't the same kid.
And so the remainder of the movie is them trying to figure out what the murders are, who's killing people. There's the mystery at the school. The sheriff goes up and he gets involved in figuring out what's up. And pretty much that's the rest of the movie.
The acting was spot on. Every single character was, even the secondary and tertiary characters were really well done.
The only issue with the tertiary characters is that it's very clear this movie was shot in New Zealand, because the unimportant parts, they started having their accent leak through. And I'm like, you're not really from Illinois. You're from down under.
Yeah, early on in the film, some, like, for instance, the mayor, he was dubbed by somebody who was clearly in a studio, whereas the actual scene, the sound was on set in the building, the supermarket. And so it was clearly different, and it was that way throughout. Every time this man spoke, it was somebody who had just done an ADR session that never matched up. And sometimes it was out of sync, because whatever the man was saying, the lip flap was different from what was being delivered in the studio. And this happened a couple times with a couple different characters, which makes me think the Australians or the New Zealanders may have been speaking idiomatically with different slang and whatnot that's localized and not what we would say, which would just throw it off.
But even the dubbing didn't take away from the acting. Oh, like, no. The girl, like, the lady who was being attacked after the bathtub, her crawling across the floor and trying to talk into the phone, the desperation in her voice and the desperation in her whole mannerism was really compelling, I thought.
I did love the fact that they got some really high-powered, you know, actors that Americans would recognize, since this is supposed to be, you know, an American town. So they got Louise Fletcher, they got Mark McClure, who had been working, you know, steadily in Hollywood.
They got the guy from the old assistant to the police sheriff is the guy from Petticoat Junction and, like, Citizen Kane and, like, a dozen other movies. You're like, I know that dude.
So they had a really good cast, and this is something that was kind of common in those days in certain exploitation films, how they would get people who are recognizable in multiple countries, especially the target country, and not just relying on the local talent, even though they're no slouches by any means.
Who was it that played Dr. Parkinson? I recognized her from something else,
She's
too.
A British actress. I actually recognized her name. I can't remember what it is, but when I saw it, it's Fiona Lewis. And I'm pretty sure I've seen her in a couple other things. Mm-hmm. And she reminds me of another actress who came up a little later, Mazetta Vander, who's a Dutch actress who's been in a lot of those Full Moon movies, among other things, and episode of Buffy.
The other thing that the movie gets really, really right, I love the cinematography throughout all of this.
Brilliant.
There's this one scene that is a little bit like the scene from Tenebrae, the long shot over the house, but not quite to that extreme, where they come driving up and they're like, they want to pick up some dates and like, well, what about her, Sally Brown? And like, no, Sally Brown, she's like 13. I was like, I got no problem with that, you sick motherfucker. And they drive off. And the camera then pushes in on the house and like up to the window in this one long take. And I thought that was really well done. There was also that one shot where the secretary is coming home from the end of the day after her shift at the hospital, and it's this one long shot down the corridor with the strong diagonal stripes on the floor, and the way the lines to the vanishing point focused in on her, I thought, was really strong.
Was that right before she turns off the bank of lights, one right after the other?
Yeah, and then the lights and the shadow then start playing with the corridor. So whoever did the DP on this thing was fucking on point.
I love the shot of the town square where they have the cop shop, and they shoot it at like dusk or whatever, sunset, and it's just the way they have the fluorescent lights on the buildings that have the old walkways and everything at that time of night. It was just freaking beautiful. I just loved the color palette.
Also, another neat thing about that particular shot and a lot of the other shots to show the downtown is a lot of the buildings are buildings that were once previously being used for something else. There's several businesses that are repurposed houses. There's a few houses that are repurposed buildings, and I believe the police station itself is a repurposed church because it's got that big long steeple looking thing.
That's another parallel for the movie and Dead and Buried, where Dead and Buried had this washed out color palette, and it had this very worn feeling about the town and this very homogenized, just kind of this same dead feeling. And this movie kind of invokes that feeling too, where it's just washed out palette.
Well, that's kind of why it reminded me of Phantasm.
Well, they did have a lot of the old town feel that some of New Zealand and Australian towns have in movies like, oh my God, there were the Ocker movies from Australia, where you'd have the bumpkin from Australia go to other places, and they would shoot in, say, England, but it was actually Australia, and they're walking around in these towns that look like the Wild West, where you have the walkways, the covered walkways with the railings and stuff, very 19th century looking, as if the colonization hadn't gone away entirely and that they were still in the previous period in their history.
One of the other interesting things about the movie, and something very similar again back to Dead and Buried, was that this movie has a very timeless feel about it. All the cars are like from the 50s. Like the music at the dance party was from the 60s, but they are wearing 70s clothes and 80s hairstyles. So you can't really say, okay, this was 1977.
So it kind of has this sort of, it's like a live-action Hayao Miyazaki movie.
A little bit, yeah. Where it was just timeless. It was, you can't pin down where it was.
Mm-hmm. And it has a very, it's very visceral. I mean, even out in the middle of the country, there's this kind of visceral feel to everything, as if, you know, you can just, I don't know, I just get a sense of the place. Like, I've been there before, you know, kind of thing. Because when I was a kid, I ended up in some small towns like that, so it had this really just familiar feel to it, and it had this sort of flesh. I don't know other how to describe it other than it felt like I was sometimes in a situation like that, and it gave my sense memory of places like that this real jolt.
Well, that's why they wound up shooting in Australia, New Zealand, sorry, my bad. That's why they wound up shooting in New Zealand, because they couldn't find a town that was small town Americana enough for them. They had to go overseas. So that invoking of the sense memory was very on purpose. It was supposed to feel like every place but no place.
Yeah, it's kind of like the American dream has been dumbed down and co-opted to the point where you have to go to a foreign country to get the United States again. Another aspect of this film that I really love is the music done by Tangerine Dream, who did the majority of the music with the exception of the source material, the songs at the from particular scenes, but they did the overall soundtrack. And one thing they did that really freaked me out, because I'm a big fan of the Terminator, and this movie has a lot of parallels to the Terminator, but it came out 3 years before, in 1981. And they have this motif that has this hollow pipe sound where the sound goes up for a few seconds and back down and goes with the music, and it sounds like the sounds from the Terminator when the machine shows up, and there's the sound of the machine's heartbeat, the boom, 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 and it has the same sound to it.
The music reminds me a little bit of what they did for The Burning. That kind of one synth playing the weird ethereal music.
Yeah, I can get that.
It's not a close parallel. It's not a complete perfect fit, but it's similar enough.
And this came out in the period of a few years where Tangerine Dream were doing movies like Gothic. I think they did the soundtrack for that movie, if I'm not mistaken.
Could be right.
They were doing, it might not have been Gothic I'm thinking of, but they did a number of movies with heightened reality to them.
And I liked how the movie builds with, like, suspense and tension and not a lot of actual real gore, like the eye-stabbing Marathon Man scene or the bathtub scene with the fat chick wasn't that gory. It was more suspense.
Yeah, and even the throat slashing is relatively mild. It's done in a way that doesn't really evoke any nausea, just more like a yeah, kind of thing.
So the movie really is more, it builds and trades in suspense and mood and atmosphere more than just visceral, oh my God, I don't believe they did this.
Yeah, it's done more to illustrate than to sicken. It's kind of what Stephen King once said in Stephen King's World of Horror, that you have two types of movies like this. You've got the horror and the gross out. He went for the gross out. This goes for the horror.
One other point where it twists expectations that we hadn't mentioned. Spoiler for the very, very end. Now, you've got in your horror movies have trained you up to this point to expect a jump scare. You know, Alice is going to get in the canoe, drift out into the middle of Crystal Lake, and Jason's going to jump her. That sort of thing. This movie ends on a happy note. You get this church, it's this wedding, you think something sinister is going to happen. Oh no, they have a happy wedding, and they get in the car and they drive off into the sunset.
I was expecting another mechanized killing. I was expecting the sheriff to suddenly, you know, whoosh, you know, like he'd been programmed subliminally at some point before his wife's death as maybe a hedge against the professor, the doctor's experiments failing altogether.
Kind of like what happened in Dead and Buried, where mm-hmm. it turns out the sheriff was really dead all along. Same sort of thing, but not really.
This still plays with your expectations a little bit, because initially when I saw this scene, I was thinking, oh, it's Peter and the receptionist that are going to get married. But no, it's the sheriff and his long-term girlfriend. And I was like, oh, okay.
So you got any final thoughts then on Strange Behavior?
I loved certain aspects of it. I like it. I definitely don't dislike it. It's one that I would probably watch again, maybe in the recent future, because I like Australian movies, especially exploitation.
In your pantheon of Australian movies, where would you guys put this?
I would put it a couple of steps beneath Dead End Drive-In. I mean, you've got Anthony Ganane.
That's fair.
You've got, oh my God, the one director who I can't remember the name of. He looks kind of like a short James Cameron. And he does a lot, he did a lot of the exploitation. And then you've got Brian Trenchard-Smith at the top.
Yeah, putting it a little below Dead End Drive-In would be very fair. I mean, I enjoyed that film, but I can't honestly say it's a very quality film. It's enjoyable, but there's, you know, you can tell it was filmed on the cheap. This one, the pacing could use a little help. It's a little slow-paced.
It is very much a slow burn, and that's not necessarily going to sit well with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
If you can temper your expectations and just kind of lose yourself in the interesting characters and the compelling situation, I think this movie has a lot to offer.
I would put this as a double bill with Stage Fright. I think I'm thinking of the right movie. Australian murder slasher film in a theater. Not in terms of saying, you know, it's a slasher film with a lot of gore, but it just reminds me it has a theme of costume killers going around knocking people off, as opposed to other Australian movies that came out of the period, like Long Weekend or something like that. This is of its kind.
It's very much not a slasher flick. You see it billed occasionally as a slasher flick. This isn't it.
Yeah, no. Which is why I would put it with a slasher film, because you get the flip sides. You get one kind of film, then you get the other. And so they kind of balance each other out.
All right, well, I guess that sounds like an episode then, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
So, Ashley, would you see Dead Kids?
No. I only found one scene that really made my skin kind of crawl. That was the pool scene, only because I nearly drowned 9 years ago in upstate New York. That pushed my buttons. But apart from that, no. I don't find anything really objectionable to the point where it should be seized.
All right. No, I mean, that's fair enough. The movie is not necessarily very bloody or violent or visceral. I think that it's kind of disturbing. I thought the Tor Johnson attack was really, really creepy. I thought, and that led into the drowning scene or the potential mm-hmm. drowning scene. So I thought that whole sequence was really tense. And then the Marathon Man scene where he's strapped down and she's going with the needle to the eye.
Yeah, that bugged me. I don't like needles anyways, and I particularly don't like them anywhere near my eye. So that one disturbed me, and I wouldn't care to watch that scene again.
But it's nowhere near your Fulci level of eye poking.
No, it isn't. It's not like, ah! Sort of level, no, keep that thing away from my eye. It's more like,
No, it's not eye gouging, and it's not the exact same thing as Dead and Buried either. I mean, that was straight in the eye, whereas this was up here. He got put above his eyeball, whereas in Dead and Buried, he goes straight to the frickin' eye.
So I would seize it, but it sounds like you two would not.
No. Yeah. No, I'd let it stay on the shelf.
I'd acquit.
All right, on the shelf it remains. Brad, did you like Dead Kids?
Yes, I did. I thought it was well constructed. I didn't see anything in it that I would consider a technical flaw. The storytelling was a little bit slow paced at times, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's a slow burn that is not going to be for everyone. Some people are just going to be like, I can't do this movie.
Well, I thought it was a particularly good movie. I thought it was strongly reminiscent of the type of movies, the mad scientist films of the 50s and even 40s and maybe even further back, like Frankenstein. I mean, obviously there's flashes of Frankenstein in this.
It didn't move the needle hugely, but not every movie has to.
It's definitely worth watching at least once, I think.
All right. So not a perfect movie, but not a waste of your time. So seek it out. Strange behavior indeed. Next week, we're going to go even stranger because next week, Dario Argento is back on the list. We're going to be watching Deep Red. It's going to be giallorific. So, in the meantime, why don't you drop us an email and send us some thoughts our way. TheVideoNastyProject@gmail.com is the address, and we'll catch you next week. And until that time, stay evil.
Well, there they are, 2,000 girls. May I ask what you're going to do with them?
We're going to find the fat ones.